something upset.
It's a minute past seven, and here's Julie Mayer with the last programme in the series of Cat Tales.
Right, today. Tomorrow, Radio 5 starts. The most important breakthrough in radio since Terry Wogan went off the television. The only thing I'm worried about is, will the studios be ready? With a couple of idiots like Albert and Herbert involved, I have my doubts. Anyway, here we are.
Oh, it's herself
in person. Miss
Albert, it's the last programme and you still don't know who I am, do you?
Of course I do. You're...
Yes?
Trudy from Fat's Nails.
No, Julie from Cat's Tales.
That's what I said.
Anyway, the important thing is Radio 5 ready for the Grand Gala opening tomorrow?
Of course it is. August, the famous 27th.
When the mighty Radio 5 comes to your very own planet.
The telephones? Are they working?
All properly plugged. You can even fool Manchester.
And the coffee.
And they'll put you up for the breakfast show.
And the bookshelf for the book programme.
And the tea maker.
But what about the recording suite? I can't see that.
What?
You have to have a suite, Herbert.
Oh, do I? Oh, then I'll have a licorice all sorts.
No, not that kind of suite. S-U-I-T-E, that kind of suite.
Oh, I thought it spelled suit.
He did. He's wearing it.
My recording suit.
Had it made specially, he did.
It's a proper recording suit. You see, it's got a little microphone in the lapel, and if you press the middle button...
No, 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 no.
No?
No. A recording suite is all the things you need to make programmes. Microphones and tape recorders... and gramophones, and the thing you push to make the green light go on.
Yeah, that must be that stuff in them cardboard boxes.
It must be.
But you sent them down to...
He comes today.
You'd best hurry.
Who are we talking about?
The scrap metal man. I left that stuff for him.
Best price is paid for your old junk. Any old junk.
That's right. He once tried to buy Jimmy Savile.
Cheek of
it. We were outraged.
Jimmy Savile's not old junk.
Certainly not.
He's a beautifully preserved antique.
Anyway, hadn't I better get that stuff back before it disappears?
Too right. If you don't... Oh, I daren't think what him upstairs would do to you, Albert.
Oh, he wouldn't send me to work in... No, it's too horrible to contemplate.
He would. He can be awful tough when he chooses.
No, but not the archers. Oh, I must hurry.
Right, Herbert. While he's away, let's listen to the final episode of The Last Vampire.
Outside by the courtyard gates of Castle Alucard, Ommel Hummelschraft stamped his giant-sized boots and cursed the snow. He called out impatiently to a couple of late-returning villagers who had yet to add their wood to the bonfire piled high against the castle wall. "Quickly!" he bellowed, "before this weather ruins all our plans!" The burly farmer crossed to the bonfire and touched the bottom of the pile of wood with a blazing torch. A roar of approval went up from the half-circle of watching villagers. But Hummelschraft had barely stepped back from the bonfire when a dark shape swept down from the sky and an outstretched wingtip brushed the side of his face. "Vampires! Vampires!" he cried. Half a dozen at least of the black-winged, sharp-clawed, razor-toothed, furry creatures could now be seen in the orange glow of the bonfire, wheeling and screaming overhead in the scurrying snowflakes. The villagers struck out right and left. They kept up an unceasing attack on the vampire bats, which swooped, dived, rose, regrouped, circled again, and struck about their ears. Then, with all of this furious activity going on outside the castle walls, the coach house doors were suddenly flung open wide in the courtyard. Four half-starved, mangy wolves rushed out, yelping sharply, the pack leader at their head, dragging behind them the antique sleigh with its silver bells jangling away on their velvet cords. Count Alucard, whip in hand and black cloak flying out behind him, sat in the driving seat, leaning forward, with Henry perched precariously at his side. Behind them, in the passenger seat, sat Emily and Albert Hollins, both clinging on for dear life as the sleigh rattled over the flagstones beneath a thin covering of snow. The desperate villagers barely noticed that the castle's inhabitants had sped through their ranks and gone. Lengthening their stride, the wolves bounded on, heading now towards the familiar cover of the pine forest. Count Alucard, tightening his grip on the reins, steered the sleigh round gently and aimed it towards the Hollins' campsite. Whoa there, my children of the night, she called out softly. Whoa now, easy, easy does it. The sleigh drew silently to a halt. Albert Hollins jumped down from the passenger seat and ran towards the car, hoping against hope that the old engine would start at the first time of asking. The Count got down from the sleigh and stood silently watching the family prepare to go home.
What are you going to do, Count? Said Henry. You won't be able to stay here now that the villagers know about you.
Count Alucard shrugged and shook his head. I've got to stay here, he said. I've lived here all my life, like my ancestors before me. It's the only home I know.
Why don't you come back home with us, Count? Suggested Henry.
May I?
The Count was touched at this kind offer. Henry turned to his father.
He can if he wants to, can't he, father?
Begged the boy. Well, Albert paused in the act of opening a tin and wondered how his neighbours would react to the idea of having a genuine vampire living next door to them.
Oh, blow the neighbours. Let them think what they want.
He can come with us if he fancies it, said Albert. What do you say, Emily? The long line of cars, which stretched back along the dusty road as far as the eye could see, edged closer towards the dockside in the waiting car ferry. Up near the head of the queue, at the wheel of the family saloon, Albert Hollins sucked at his teeth and drummed his fingers impatiently on the steering wheel. Albert had failed to notice the two uniformed officials who, having inspected the documents of the occupants of the vehicles in front, were now moving towards his car. One of them, a red-faced man with a pointed moustache, rapped on the car roof with the palm of his hand, while the second, who wore rimless glasses and had bushy eyebrows, bent down and peered inside the car. Albert wound down the window.
Excuse me, sir, said the red-faced man. Could we see your passports?
In the back of the car, Henry was aware of the Count's long fingers fidgeting nervously with the hem of his cloak. It immediately occurred to Henry what was worrying the Count. He hadn't got a passport.
That seems to be in order, sir, said Redface, handing the passports back.
He stuck his head in at the window and peered at the Count.
And could I have a look at yours now, sir? He said.
As a matter of fact,
stuttered the Count. His hand fumbled for and found the car's door handle. He flung open the door and took to his heels along the dockside. Henry turned and stared aghast through the rear window.
Come back, he called. Don't run. Come back. It'll be all right.
But the Count was already out of earshot, running hard, as fast as his long legs would carry him, with both men in hot pursuit. The red-faced official had tugged a whistle from his shirt pocket and was blowing short, sharp blasts on it as he ran. More men in uniform appeared from all directions around the dockside and bore down on the Count. The line of cars had again edged forward. Albert sighed, released the handbrake, and the car moved towards the ferry.
Don't go yet, Dad, pleaded Henry. Wait for the Count. We've got to help him.
Albert shook his head. There's nothing we can do, son. I wish there was, but they wouldn't let him come with us. Not now.
Please, Dad. Please. Your Dad's right, Henry, said Emily. It's hopeless. He's a nice man, and your Dad and me are not able to help him. But if he hasn't got a passport, Henry, they'll never let him on board.
The Hollins' car rumbled up the ferry's boarding runway. In the back seat of the car, Henry Hollins knelt up and gazed out through the rear window, biting back the tears and looking for a last glimpse of Count Alucard. A silver moon was reflected in the gently lapping waters of the A 100 stars twinkled in the night sky. Inside the emigration building, the red-faced official walked along a white-walled corridor. He stopped outside a heavily bolted door.
Supper time, Your Highness, he called out jokingly to the man within.
Then, unbolting the door at top and bottom, he opened it and stepped inside. The cell was completely empty. Outside the small barred window, the black bat had found no difficulty in squeezing through the bars. It stretched out the dry folds of its wings and gave them a preliminary flutter. It opened its wings again, this time to their fullest extent, and then launched itself into the night, skimming just above the water and stars for company. The black bat headed straight towards the empty, open sea. Back in the village, several weeks had passed since the Castle Alucard had been burnt to the ground. The battle with the vampire bats had raged for hours until eventually the sinister creatures had been destroyed and buried again, deeper this time, and with new wooden stakes thrust through their evil hearts. It was an episode in their lives that the villagers would be happy to forget. Since flying across the sea and arriving in England, Count Alucard has never once returned to human form. He has spent all of his time, in the guise of a bat, searching for his young friend, Henry Hollins. Sometimes he pauses long enough to snatch a meal in a fruit-filled orchard or from a hedgerow heavy with berries. But he's soon on his way again, flitting restlessly across the tops of trees or twisting over rooftops, turning in and out of chimney pots. Try hard enough and who knows, you might catch a glimpse of the Count yourself. But if you look for him in daylight, you'll never see him. For when the sun is up, the Count is always fast asleep, hanging upside down in some tall church steeple, perhaps. Or maybe in a steadily ticking clock tower, or even in the ghostly ivy-covered shell of an ancient ruined castle. Go out there into street or field or garden after dark, stand staring upwards, and who knows? You just could be lucky enough to spot Count Alucard, the very last of the vampires, scudding across the night sky.
Albert. Oh, you do look agitated.
Oh, I am. I've just missed the last episode of The Last Vampire.
Don't worry. Victoria Wood will be on Radio 5 tomorrow morning, reading the sequel called The Vampire's Holiday. Any luck over the recording suite?
Yes and no. I met Mr. Steptoe, the BBC's Any Old Iron Man, and he said he hadn't picked it up.
Oh, so it's still there?
No. It's
disappeared?
Yeah.
I've got an idea.
Oh, dear, this could be disastrous.
No, I bet those Radio 5 drama people saw it and borrowed it.
Well, the Radio 5 drama producer's cell is just next door. Why don't you look in?
Take the fire!
There's a war going on in there.
Don't be silly. That's Blitz Cat.
Blitz what?
Blitz Cat. It's a serial about a cat during the war.
Anyway, first thing of me wasn't in there.
Maybe it's along here. In here, perhaps. Look at this. A room full of famous people.
Ooh.
They're all practicing their stories. That's celebrity stories, where famous people tell us their favourite stories. There's my old mate, Andy Crane. He's reading Truckers.
Truckers is the story of a lot of little gnomes who live in a store. Gnomes take everything literally. They take things at face value. They're trying to be humans, but they don't quite have human perception of things. When they're driving their truck away from a sign that says roadworks ahead, and one turns to the other and says, well, that's good, we didn't want a road that didn't work.
Yeah, you'll never believe this. I just saw Bill Oddie in a frock.
That's Bill's new frock.
It didn't look very new.
No, it's a play he's in called Bill's New Frock. He's probably wearing it to get the right feeling for the part.
But they still didn't have Sirs. What do you call it? I'm going to have a look along here.
Oh, Herbert. Look who's in here.
It can't be.
It is. He's talking to Garth Crooks.
It's Gather.
He's telling him about his favourite records.
When we're 13, 14... used to have rock and roll competitions when we were young kids, you know, and Elvis was playing all the time, and used to do the bop and everything. It was great, you know.
He must be on sporting albums. Hey, Herbert, what do you think Albert's got to?
He went this way.
Oh, hello.
What are you doing?
Found a tape lying here. I thought we ought to put it on. It's jolly interesting. Would you like to hear it?
Of course we would. The last episode of The House of Ardor.
Edred and Elfrida were so close to rescuing their father and Uncle Drim from the Hidden City, but now 1,000 men, armed with 1,000 poisoned arrows, were heading towards them. And the children, who had been disguised as cats by Mouldiwarp, knew that the city's inhabitants would kill them all before allowing them to escape. Cousin Richard could see that there was no time for Mouldiwarp, who had already carried Uncle Drim up to the cliff top, to help carry both himself and Lord Arden up.
It's no use. They'll be here before Mouldy can get both of us up the cliff. Quick, you two cats. Start scratching us a way out.
What? Through the cliffside?
Here. I'll show you. Scratch. With your paws. Like this.
All right, we'll try.
Just a minute. Is all this escaping business making me hear things? Or did those animals speak?
No. Yes.
What?
Well, they're not really cats and a bear. They're... Oh, look, there isn't time to explain now. Keep scratching, that's it. There's a hole coming. Keep going.
The men from the city, they're getting nearer.
There. There's a wide enough crack now. Come on, come on, come on, come on. In with you all.
Go on, Lord Arden. Squeeze through the crack.
But Jim, what about Jim? I can't do without Jim.
He's already halfway there. Now, come on, come on, come on, come on, I say. All of you, through the crack.
One by one, Mouldiwarp pushed them all into the narrow gap. And once Mouldy was safely inside too, the cliff face closed up firm and fast, just as their pursuers reached it.
I didn't think we were going to make it. Where are we?
It's some sort of tunnel. Keep with us, you cats.
Seems to be getting wider.
Yeah, and it's lighter too further on. Hey, look where it's brought us out.
Huh?
It's the smuggler's cave.
Those cats did speak. I must be dreaming. Talking animals, smuggler's caves. Oh, Jim, there you are. Oh. I thought we'd lost you.
Oh, and I was wondering if I'd ever see you again.
Lord Arden, you and Jim must leave through that wooden door up there. It'll take you home.
Home?
To Arden Castle. That's your home now.
But what about you and the animals?
Yes, aren't you coming?
No. I won't be seeing you again. I have to get back to my own time. I mean, place. But don't worry about us. We'll be all right.
Well, if you're sure. Come on, Jim. Let's see if the door will really just take us home to Arden.
Goodbye, all of you.
And thank you for all you've done.
Oh, Edred. What if we never see them again? I hated to see Father and Uncle Jim go. Just in case.
Look, Edred. There's the white clock.
But next moment, there it wasn't. For, with a cheery wave of Edred, had leapt onto the minute hand, and he and it vanished quickly together.
Goodbye, Richard, and thank you. I suppose it means we won't ever see Cousin Richard again. Does it, Mouldy?
Part and sad, ain't it? That's why it'd be best done quick.
And what about you, Mouldy? Will we ever see you again?
You'll see me every night at dinner.
At dinner?
Why, ain't I the Arden crest? And ain't I on every knife, fork and spoon in the place? Now then, if you'd been taking notice instead of taking up time, you'd have seen the clock's back.
I suppose we'd better go then. Thank you for everything, Mouldy. We've had the most exciting time, even though we never found the treasure.
No. But the spell did ask me to make you brave and wise and kind. And I reckon you're both a bit nearer to finding out how to be that.
I hope so.
Molly, come on. Come along, come along. Sit on the set, man. That's it. Come on now, old clock. Take this worrits and pear back to Arden Knoll for the last time. And out of my hair.
Goodbye, Mouldy. Goodbye. We're back on Arden Knoll.
It's a relief, I suppose.
Poor old tumble-down Arden Castle. It looks quite ordinary, doesn't it, after seeing it the way we did in olden days?
Yes, well, I think I like it best in our days. At least it's not so dangerous.
I suppose we should get back home to it, then.
I'm almost afraid to. Oh, Edred, what if it was all just a sort of double dream we had? What if Father isn't really home at all?
And well, there's only one way to find out, Elf. Come on, we've got to find out sooner or later.
At first, the children hurried quickly towards their house at Arden Castle. But then, increasingly afraid of what they might find, or rather not find, footsteps slowed. As they approached, almost unwillingly now, they could see Aunt Edith waiting to meet them at the door. Her face, as they drew nearer, was as pale as the pearl and ivory of the white clock.
Aunt Edith looks upset. Maybe we're late for supper or something and she's cross.
Oh, children, children!
Auntie Edith, what is it?
Oh, something wonderful. So wonderful you won't believe. What do you think's happened?
Is it... Has Daddy come home?
Yes. Yes, and Uncle Jim. But you'll never guess the rest. They've been kept prisoners in South America, and an English boy with a performing bear helped them to escape.
No mention of cats?
Cats? I don't know.
Oh, never mind that. Are they all right, Daddy and Uncle Jim?
Yes, but they've had the most dreadful time of it. Months and months of escaping across the interior, and your poor Daddy had fever and doesn't remember much except the fever making him believe the bear was Mouldiwarp, our Arden Crest, you know, come to life. But he's all right now, only a bit weak, so you must be very quiet and gentle.
But we can see him, can't we?
Yes, we can see him, please.
Of course you can. Come on, then. Oh, isn't it too good to be true? Just too very good to be true.
But, as the children were to find, it was true, if all very wonderful and mysterious. Maybe, if you go a little below the crust, and are not content to think nothing can be true unless it is uninteresting. Edred and Elfrida knew it was true when they stood in the doorway of the parlour and saw that the face that smiled across the room at them was really that of their father.
Daddy! Oh, Daddy, it's really you!
Of course it's me. Well, are you both just going to stand there and goggle? Don't I at least get a hug,
It was just another moment that the children stood at the door. But it was one of those moments that are as short as a watch tick and as long as a year. Had it all, they wondered, just been a dream? Had there ever been any Mouldiwarp or any treasure? And then, in one flash, they were across the room and in their father's arms. And they both knew that Mouldiwarp or no Mouldiwarp or no dream, the treasure was theirs.
I liked that.
Oh, so did I.
What's that funny sound?
It's coming from in here.
I don't believe it. Radio 5 starts tomorrow and these two are asleep on the job.
Don't be silly. That's Simon and Trevor. They're having a sleep because they've got to start really early at 8.45 to introduce Radio 5's big opening.
8.45 early? Why, when I was a lad...
I bet that was when dinosaurs ruled the earth.
Huh?
Anyhow, Bruno Brooks had to be up much earlier. He has to do the 7 o'clock show on Radio 1, and he's hardly time for a muesli and marmalade sandwich. Before he's listening to himself on Radio 5.
Getting up at 7? Well, that's nothing. I used to get up at 4.30, wash in ice-cold water, then...
I know. Go and help Bill Stonehenge.
Boys, don't squabble. You'll wake them up. Anyway, this isn't helping us find our recording suite, is it?
Well, I don't know where it can be. We've looked everywhere.
And here we are, back at the Radio 5 studio. Come on.
Hello. It's a young person come to find out about Radio 5.
Hello? Are you my analyst?
Don't fret, Sonny. We won't bite. Only I'm afraid you're a day early. Radio 5 doesn't start till tomorrow.
I know perfectly well when Radio 5 starts. If I rule the world.
I know who you are. You're Noddy, come to ask for a job.
I am not Noddy. I am David Kipperfeet Hatch. I am mad. I mean MDR.
MDR? It's Mad himself.
Oh, dear. Oh, whoops. The man upstairs.
The chief. Managing Director Radio.
Funny. I thought he'd be bigger than that.
Oh, I expect he was. Probably wore himself to a frazzle looking after our welfare. Didn't you, sir? Oh, sir, sir, may I polish your shoes? Can I brush your coat?
Herbert.
Oh, Albert, don't interrupt me when I'm engaged in a labour of love.
I think he's trying to point out that that's the paintbrush you're dusting Sir down with. The one you were painting the door green with.
Never mind, never mind. It goes with the purple. And it's nice to know there's one BBC employee. Grovel. Oh, no.
Lower, lower.
Nevertheless, I must ask you, why did I find this extremely expensive recording suite, £2 at the very least, lying on the pavement outside?
It's the Radio 5 recording suite.
Sirs, found it.
His suite.
Yes, he is, rather.
Thank you. It's a good job for you I did find it. I got a couple of my slaves, staff, to carry it up here and assemble it. But I demand to know...
what it was doing there. Oh, yes, I quite understand,
yes.
Sir. And Herbert...
it's a long story. Much too long to waste extraordinarily valuable time.
Oh, a terribly dreadfully busy man like yourself, sir.
Sire,
I've got an idea. While you're here, why don't you tell the kids...
young persons...
all about Radio 5.
Oh, can I? Really? Broadcast to the nation? I mean, if you insist.
Just speak into this. We'll do the rest. It's called a microphone.
Good gracious. I've been making one of those all morning.
Here's the script. I've adapted it for you, Your Honour.
Cue music.
Right. Hello, young persons everywhere. This is Uncle David Hatch, and I'd love to tell you about the super-duper shows for Kitty Ringson. I can't speak this garbage. Who wrote it?
I did.
You can't get the stuff these days. Listen, Radio 5 is new, dynamic, fun, and modern. It is because I say it is! Thank you very much. Thank you. Press the pink button.
The pink button?
Yes! Young folks, this is Dynamic David, and I'm Mad, Managing Director Radio, so I'm pretty darn important, boo-boo, but I rip myself away from my mind-boggling responsibilities to hype you up about stupendous Radio 5. Starting tomorrow on 693 and 909 kilohertz, medium wave, 693 and 909. So, super glue yourself to your tranny and stand by for Radio 5 Blast Off!
Oh, sir, that was terrific. You're an inspiration to all young broadcasters like myself.
Oh, I was moved, deeply moved. Oh, your golden word will be engraved in my heart. They will that.
It was indeed truly marvellous, if I may be allowed to say so, Your Magnificence. Hello? He's gone. Oh, typical.
That's it, then. Don't forget, you lot. 693 and 909 medium wave. Just for once, this is your radio, not theirs. Bye, boys. I'm off. Don't forget to put the cat out, Herbert.
Of course I won't. Come on, get Maggie. Come on, puss, 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 puss. Nice puss. Who's a nice puss?
The cat sales competition results will be announced in Radio 5's Saturday morning show, On Your Marks. That's next Saturday morning at 9 o'clock on Radio 5. Cat's Tales was presented by Julie Mayer, produced by Julia Brooke, and written and directed by John Scottney. Victoria Wood read The Last Vampire by Willis Hoare, adapted by Alfred Bradley. Penelope Keith was the narrator in The House of Arden by Edith Nesbit, dramatised by Chris Curry. Those taking part were Henry Power, Kelly Bright, Marcia King, Michael Graham Cox, Joe Kendall, Daphne Oxenford, Russell Dixon, Donald G., John Hassler, Arnold Peters, Fraser Carr, and David Hatch. Tomorrow morning, at 8:45, you can hear Trevor and Simon preparing for the launch of the new Radio 5 network on 909 and 693 medium wave. It kicks off with Bruno Brooks presenting Take 5 with music, quizzes, and stories. The guests are Mark Curry and Paul Gazza Gascoigne, and Victoria Wood reading episode 1 of The Vampire's Holiday. This is Radio 4, and now a good read. Here's Edward Blishen.
Hello. I try to make a neat parcel of my guests, and I suppose the string I could tie the parcel with today is the fact that they're both concerned with stormy and indeed passionate relationships.